All right, what's up, everyone? Thank you once again for tuning in to another episode of Our Lives in Medicine. This episode features the Procrastination MD, aka Jess. Take a listen to learn about neurology, her path to and through residency so far, and just some pretty cool stories about life in general. This is a really fun episode to record, and I hope you all enjoy. And as always, make sure to support the fam by following us on Instagram at Our Lives in Medicine. Check the link in the bio for other ways to interact and engage with the family. Please feel free to share the episodes with anyone you think will be interested and enjoy. And make sure to drop a like and a review on iTunes or anywhere else that you listen to our podcast. We really appreciate your support. Couldn't do this without you. And we hope you enjoy. Cheers to the future. Procrastination MD, Jess, aka Jess. Jess, say hi to the world.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jessica.
And is Procrastination MD okay, or do you need me to call you like doctor or anything, or how do you want to go from here?
I mean, do whatever feels right, I guess. Like today, I introduced myself to like an elderly couple as Jessica because I felt weird introducing myself as like doctor because I was like, I feel like you're my grandparents.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah. That's like, I had a kid today in clinic, like 4 years old. She's like, what's your name? I was like, Everett. I'm not going to be like, I'm Dr. Wilson. Call me Dr. Wilson, right. 4-year-old child. So, yeah, cool. So how is everything going?
Pretty good. I'm coming towards the end of second year of neurology residency, which is pretty exciting. I can't believe it, like that I'm technically almost halfway done. So yeah, I mean, that's exciting. Everything else is going all right for the most part, you know, never ending quest of work-life balance.
Of course. Wait, what do you mean coming to, you're halfway done with second year?
Oh, halfway done with residency.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Because neuro's 4 years, right?
Yes.
Okay, sweet. So yeah, you're halfway done just about. I mean, weeks away from being halfway done.
I know.
How has the road been so far?
You know, it's been wild, to say the least. I mean, I think that starting your medical career in the midst of a pandemic, 10 out of 10, would not recommend. I'm sure you agree. Can relate. Like it just, I don't know. I think that just changes the game for like the people who are training right now, because people, you know, like our attendings and stuff like that, we're like, well, back in my day, like we will be, you know, the group that's like, well, back in my day, we started in the midst of a pandemic, like craziness. So it's been a wild road. I think like, honestly, the whole process to get through medical school and then to end it with the pandemic almost seems like on brand for me for some reason. But it's been good. It's been also weird though, because I think with the pandemic, I don't know if you can relate to this, but making friends and socializing was significantly more difficult. And in residency and stuff, you really need, I think, a close-knit group of friends that you can lean on throughout the process. But I don't know.
Did you go to residency, like implant in a new city completely? Yes. Away from everything you've ever met?
Yes. So yeah, that's tough. I moved from Miami, Florida. So my sister was in Florida at the time, but I moved from Miami, Florida to Kansas City, Missouri. And I'm originally from the Midwest, but not this Midwest. Mm-hmm. It's a very different Midwest than what I'm used to. But I've done that before, you know, with medical school, college, undergrad and stuff, I've moved to places where I didn't really know anybody, but I think, again, moving with everything closed down was just weird. You know, trying to move into an apartment and buy things you need was weird and unnecessarily difficult. So it's been, I guess, a lesson in adapting, maybe. I don't know if I've gotten good at
right.
it.
Yeah, so. I mean, I had to move into my apartment sight unseen, which I regretted because I moved out after a year. But yeah, it's tough not having the normal social outlets for meeting people. How did you get by? What did you do to meet people?
The answer is barely. I barely got by. My intern year was medicine, right? So we had a plus one week. So every fifth week you had your clinic week. So my clinic group of people was a really great bunch. One of them, who's a second year internal medicine resident, Sarah, me and her just vibed. Like, we just got along immediately for some reason. And so I'm thankful for that because she was like my mini vacation every 5 weeks in intern year. I just had a friend that I could be weird with and like talk about anything. And that was, I think, really important for me. But also at the time, so my partner was in Grenada, which is where I went to medical school. So I wasn't sure if I was going to see him at all during like 2020. I saw him in February for his birthday, but then everything shut down. And so I really wasn't sure if I was going to be able to see him that year. And thankfully, he flew up in October, like when Grenada finally opened its borders for flight. He booked like one of the first flights out like at the end of October, and he's been here now like since then. And I think he's a big factor for why I didn't completely lose my mind in intern year. But yeah, I think having that community, I mean, making friends and stuff, like I was able to do it, but I think he was a big, huge support for me that I think I didn't really realize I needed. And I'm very thankful for that, like very thankful. Because you're not with your neurology people until the second year, so.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad that he was able to get off the island, first of all. And like, you're right, that's terrible timing for you and for him.
Yeah, just really, really threw a lot of kinks into a lot of plans that year.
Yeah.
But it was just a lot of unknown. But I feel like, again, that's kind of the whole journey with medicine, is a lot of unknown and just kind of going at it day by day, not really knowing what's going to happen sometimes, which is very scary more often than not.
100%. So when we talked on the phone, I didn't know you moved from Miami. What part of Miami were you in?
So I was living in close to Brickell. How familiar are you with Miami?
I worked at UMiami for 2 years, and then I went to med school in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay, so I lived in Edgewater.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah, and my sister was living in Pompano, well, right on the edge of Pompano, Fort Lauderdale area. So she was a little more north. But yeah, I lived in Edgewater, right near Wynwood, for like a year and a half. So I actually moved from Brooklyn, New York, which is where I did 6 months of my third year. And then moved from Brooklyn, New York. Like, I took my shelf exam for medicine or something like that on a Friday, had to be in Miami that Monday. So it's not the first time that I've actually rented a building or like a place sight unseen. We had a wonderful realtor that helped us out finding a place down there. So that was the first time I actually saw a place or like rented based on like not actually being physically there in a place and just kind of trusting the realtor.
Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah, but it's Miami, you know.
Yeah, you can see it and still end up in a dump. You never know.
Yeah, there's always the beach and things to do. I mean, here it's a little more landlocked.
Yeah.
So, not the same.
That's cool though. So I was in Gables mostly. I worked at the hospital downtown, but I lived like right off Miracle Mile in Gables. Yeah, it was pretty sweet. And then I went to Nova Southeastern for med school. That's up in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah. That's where the Dolphins practice site is, isn't it?
Yeah, right on campus. Yeah, it's pretty sweet. It's about the only benefit of being there. Well, not the only benefit besides being in Fort Lauderdale, of course.
Yeah, my sister used to work for the Miami Dolphins, so that's the only reason I knew that.
Oh, sweet. Right on. So now you're in KC. How are you liking it there versus being in Miami versus being in Brooklyn?
So it's different. It's funny because my partner was like, during residency interviews, I'm very thankful for what he told me, because he was like, you know, don't worry about me, just worry about the place that you're going to get the best training. And I really took that to heart, because I'm so happy with my program. I'm so happy with my attending staff, my fellow residents. I'm very happy with that. But most places that I interviewed at, I was there for less than 24 hours. You know, it was in, out, interview, like leave and head back to Miami, because we were still doing in-person interviews at that time. So I never really saw Kansas City, Missouri. I also didn't realize how close, like, Kansas City is actually split essentially down the middle, and like part of it's on in the Kansas side and part of it's in the Missouri side, which I didn't realize. But it's different. When I came here for interviews, it was very gray and cold because it was December. And when I drove up from Miami, it was May, and I was very surprised at how green it was and all of like the trees, and it looked really nice. But the city life downtown is, it's a small city downtown area. They have a lot of like cool, like farmers markets and stuff like that. So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. So if I had to compare it to Cleveland, Ohio downtown area, I feel like it's a smaller Cleveland, Ohio. I don't know the population size, but I do know that once you drive like 40 minutes in any direction, you're essentially on a farm out here, which I did not experience living and growing up in Ohio.
Right.
But like I said, it's the Midwest, but it's a different Midwest than what I grew up in. It feels like a more country Midwest, if that makes sense. Interesting.
And is that like a negative, a positive, or just kind of just a different experience?
Just different. I mean, you know, they have their diehard football, Kansas City Chiefs. They have the Royals. And so I'm used to coming from a city that is diehard for their sports teams and stuff like that. The people are nice, which I appreciate about the Midwest for the most part. I do miss the food choices that were available to me in both Brooklyn, New York, and Miami, Florida. That's the one thing I think I miss the most, because they like their barbecue out here, but you really have to be in the mood for barbecue. I don't think it can be like a daily thing. I'm sure it is for some people.
But yeah, barbecue's good, but yeah, I would definitely wouldn't be the one to eat it, you know, multiple times a week.
Yeah, and to be honest, with all of the residency programs that I interviewed with, I took into consideration the food they fed us, because that's important to me. And they did feed us barbecue here for the interview, and it was super good. So I was like, okay, good. Like, I'm all right with the food they fed us. It wasn't just like a random sandwich that's been sitting in a fridge for like 3 days, you know?
That's a good point. The interview food, and I don't know about for neuro, but for family med, it was, did they give us a hotel or not? That was a big deal.
Yeah, I think I only got that once, but it was for an internal medicine residency program, and I was not about it.
Interesting. So you said you got a hotel covered only once?
Yeah, only once. So I had 10 interviews. 9 of them were neurology, and I think I only had one hotel that was actually provided, you know, by the residency program.
Interesting. I didn't know that that wasn't a common thing, because for family, I did 13 and only one of them didn't provide.
Actually, I'm lying. There may have been like another neurology one, but it was a newer program, so they had like the money to spend. Mm.
So, you know, it's interesting. We talked about kind of like red flags or things like that with food. The one program that didn't cover the room is actually where I ended up matching and ended up transferring from. So I think looking back, maybe that was a sign.
Probably. This is your future. No, we don't pay for the hotel room.
Yeah, we are very clear how we feel about you. So, but hey, it is what it is. I'm out now, so I'm on the other side.
Good, good. I'm glad.
So you're in KC doing neurology. What made you pick neurology?
Well, my, I guess, fascination with the brain started in undergrad, and my, like, spiel for my interviews was, you know, you can keep a heart beating and lungs breathing, but if your brain's not working, you're not there. Except I did not say it, like, crazy like that. So I find the brain fascinating. I think, like I said, my exposure to it started in undergrad, and I learned neuroanatomy very backwards because I did research with a neuropathologist in Portland, Oregon, the summer before I graduated from my undergrad education. And so I started with like the gross specimen, right? The brain that just came out of a person who passed away within the last few hours. I didn't really know what I was looking at or what anything meant. I kind of got a sense of what the brain physically looked like, felt like, you know, what it looked like under slides and stuff like that, but I didn't really know much else. Then I went to grad school and it's just fascinating to me, like movement disorders and stuff like that, and started to learn more neuroanatomy kind of very surface level. But I got an area of concentration in clinical neuroscience with my master's degree, which allowed me to do 6 weeks of like a rotation at Case Western, which is where I got my master's from. So I did 6 weeks of a neurology rotation essentially at University Hospital there. And it was just cool to see how a lesion in the brain can affect somebody's ability to, you know, move their arm or talk normally or understand conversation or communicate in a way that makes sense. And so I tried to keep my mind open-minded towards different specialties. And I feel like everyone going into med school is always surgery, Grey's Anatomy, whatever. And then as they get exposed to certain things, like maybe not. And I was probably in that camp as well, because I did enjoy surgery. I like using my hands. I find I can focus really well when I am using my hands, which is why I like arts and crafts. But so I think that I tried to, like I said, keep my mind open towards other specialties, but I found myself always kind of gravitating towards neurology-based cases. And I just, as soon as I did my elective, it was one of those things, like, it was actually, I did my elective in Doral. With a neurologist out there who was wonderful. And it was one of those things where the first day of the rotation, it was like, this feels right. I don't know if you experienced that, you know, with family medicine or the specialty that you want to go into, but it just felt right, you know? And so that's why I decided to like actively then pursue that specialty and apply for neurology residency.
Sweet. That's awesome. Yeah. I'm glad you got that experience, because some people go all third year or whatever and just don't have that aha moment. Mm-hmm. And that's scary. It's very terrifying. Yeah,
it is. And like people, I think also though, sometimes it's okay to not know what you want to do right away, but it does become like more scary when you're supposed to make some sort of a decision and then like drop a couple $1,000 like for that decision, you know?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
So I agree with you that it's okay not to know, but my advice to whenever I get the question of, hey, what do I do? How do I figure out what I want? Especially from like a first year or even like a person who just got in is going to start in the fall. I always say figure out ASAP what you want and figure that out by knowing what you don't want to do lifestyle wise. And you can kind of piece it together from there. Because it's important to know so you can start doing research, reaching out for mentors. If you decide or figure it out late third year, early fourth year, it might be too late.
Yeah. And I think, though, for some reason, medical students get really scared, I think, to approach people, attendings, residents, what have you, to ask questions. But I feel like, and sometimes there are residents and attendings that can be scary to approach and ask questions, but if you find someone that you vibe with, even if it's just to get a better understanding of that specialty, like you said, knowing what you don't want, I think is particularly important, because, you know, you have things that you will maybe be okay with sacrificing or giving up a little bit of sleep or what have you for whatever specialty, but, you know, I think, yeah, finding out what you don't want in a specialty is just as important as finding out, like, what you want. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of options with medical specialties that we don't actually learn in medical school. Like, fellowships, you know, you can become very specialized. You can start off in an area of medicine that you really didn't technically want to go into, but you can find a way to get into an area that, like, you want to do more of, be it procedures or, you know, subspecializing in internal medicine, even like with neurology or family medicine, like there's a lot of areas that you can subspecialize into that you can kind of make like a job. You can figure out your dream job by like kind of making what you want it to be based on how you want to train. I don't know if that makes sense, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. What would be kind of your recommendation on figuring that out, maybe within the field of neurology specifically?
So I think exposure is obviously a big one, and that's easier said than done to get that exposure. But I think just asking, you know, for help or guidance from people is important. You know, even saying you don't really know what you want to do, but here's kind of what you're passionate about or what you enjoy about whatever area of medicine. And sometimes people can guide you maybe towards people who are in that field. I don't have a family. Me personally, there's no doctors in my family. So this whole concept was very foreign to me, to my family of, you know, the match, medical school, all of these things. My only exposure to physicians was either my own doctors growing up, random meet and greets or meet cutes, I guess you can say. Like I worked in a hair salon and was introduced to a cardiologist who worked at the Cleveland Clinic, who introduced me to a cardiothoracic surgeon who let me stand in on open heart surgery when I was 15. Like very random meetups. This was my exposure to medicine. But I mean, it all came through asking, because the worst someone can say is like, no, mm-hmm. you know, for whatever you're asking about, even if it's just to like pick their brain on, hey, you do this area of medicine, like, what do you like about it? What do you wish you would have done different? Is the biggest way that I can say to find out what you want to do. And I think that if someone says, is very like, no, like, I don't have time to tell you, maybe you don't want to go into the specialty that they're in. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
Everyone's different to like figure out how they, where they want to go or what they want to do. It's different for everybody, but I think the biggest thing is just to ask.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I don't have a family member I could fall back on, but I just kind of asked around. Well, I don't have a physician I could ask. My mom is a nurse, and so mm-hmm. she kind of just did the legwork for me. And like mm-hmm. you said, got me in high school. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. But then as I got older, I started out wanting to do surgery, and then I'm like, well, when I'm 45, is this what I'm really going to want to do? And that's why I changed from surgery pretty quick.
Will my back be happy with me?
Right. When I found out that a lot of surgeons end up getting back surgery, I was right. like, eh, I don't ever want back surgery.
Like, I already have a bad back myself and like neck pain, and I'm just like, I can't even stand doing normal things for 45 minutes, let alone being in weird positions and trying to cut open people for 45, like longer than 45 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. What do you have back and neck pain from?
Okay, so my injury started when I was 14. I tore my hamstring off the bone in my right leg.
Oh my God. And then avulsion fracture.
I landed in the splits on tile floor.
Oh, so it wasn't even like an athletic.
Nope.
Oh, that's not as
I
fun.
I wish it was. It was just me being a klutz. and I landed, and I kid you not, the sound is forever ingrained in my memory. It sounded like a champagne bottle pop.
Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah, it was not nice. Yeah. That's and I got nice. Up, and then I couldn't walk very well. And then, like an idiot, decided to not use crutches after a week and proceeded to cause my pelvis to completely tilt to the left and had to go to physical therapy and stuff. So I have a curvature at the bottom of my spine towards the left. I have a curvature at the top of like my thoracic spine towards the right. And then my neck looks like I've been in multiple car accidents because I've lost the curvature in my neck, but I've never been in a car accident. I've only had a few concussions.
Oh, really? Yeah. Just a few, huh?
They get at least three that I'm aware of.
Oh, my God. From what?
Sports. And, okay. You know, like when you hit your head, like you don't really think about, oh, that could be a concussion. There's, like I said, there's three I can think of that were like legit that I like remember. One was 15, when I was 15 in a basketball game. One when I was 18, I cracked my head open on a keg, which I'm not proud of. And then I think one in college that wasn't that bad, but it was during rugby. I kind of smacked my head pretty hard on the pitch.
Oh, man.
And I'm sure there's a few sprinkled in here and there, you know, with college and whatnot. I'm sure I fell a lot.
Yeah. Wow. The neurologist with the multiple brain concussions.
Right?
I like that, though. That's a good branding thing.
I mean, I want to go into sports neurology, so,
right on.
You know.
I'm doing sports med, so that's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And ironically, I had the same fracture, like the avulsion fracture where your hamstring tears off the ischium.
Yeah.
I had that when I was like ninth grade. It was on my left leg. But it was during sports. I didn't just fall. I'm sorry for you.
Yeah. Did you, you had a fracture, so it actually brought bone away?
Yeah. It was gross.
Yeah, mine was a clean tear.
Oh.
I don't know how that happened.
Ooh, that's even worse.
Yeah. It's terrible. There's like a divot in the back of my leg.
Oh, and you probably had like the fruit roll-up hamstring.
Yeah, I don't really remember a whole lot, but I know I still have my films that are at my parents' house in Ohio because MRI back then was still given on films, not on CDs.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. The guy, I just remember he was like, it'll grow back. I was like, what? That doesn't sound right.
Doesn't sound very reassuring.
No.
Yeah, I hated that. Like my hamstring and butt cheek just got all bruised and swollen. It was so gross.
Yeah, and it's like sucks. You can't pull your leg forward. You feel like you have like a dead leg. And I tried to run on that thing like months after. And like it was not normal. It was not normal. I was walking weird. People were like, what's wrong with you? And that's because I didn't use my crutches. And so my hip would rotate outward in a weird way. So I was walking like I literally had a stick up my butt.
I think yours must have been way worse then, because I was back playing lacrosse in like 3 weeks. But
yeah,
yours sounds terrible.
Mine is mostly because I was a dummy. Like if I could smack 14-year-old Jessica and be like, listen, use your stupid crutches, I would.
Yeah, 14-year-old, 16-year-old us was, you know, left a lot to be desired.
True.
So that's funny. But one thing I wanted to ask also is, you're a second year, almost third year. What are some of your common cases that you see? And then what are some, like, if you have any good juicy stories from your residency so far?
Yeah, sure. So we, at this particular residency program, it's a newer residency program. We graduated our first class last year. So this year we're graduating our second neurology residency class. We are at a few hospitals. So we're at St. Luke's Hospital here, which is a comprehensive stroke center. We are also at University Health Truman Medical Center, which is a community hospital that's more downtown, serves a different patient demographic. And then we're also at Research Medical Center, which is also a comprehensive stroke center, but we don't spend that much time there. We spend more time at University Health and St. Luke's. And then we do like 3 months of children's in third year. So stroke is obviously the big one, right? Like, especially when we're at the comprehensive stroke center at St. Luke's, we see a lot of stroke, a lot of TIA, dissections, stuff like that. Cause they have a dedicated like neuroradiology department. And so they do a lot of interventional cases. Stroke is a big one. And you know, it's always symptoms of weakness, speech difficulties, calling aphasia when it's not aphasia, when it's just dysarthria, which drives me nuts, but it's neither here nor there. We've had some interesting cases. And like the one thing, like I said, that I really love about neurology is your physical exam should really lead you to where your lesion is. And so we've had people who have had a like epidural abscess in the cervical spine, but they just looked at the lumbar spine, and based on the physical exam, they only did imaging of a lumbar spine and saw that there was an infection down there. And so essentially the consult was from neurosurgery, essentially saying we want neurology to do an exam.
So, oh, love that.
Yeah. Love it. And so that was also the first time I checked rectal tone, which was a blast. So this particular person, they're like, oh, they're flaccid paralysis of bilateral lower extremities, you know, saddle anesthesia, fecal urinary incontinence. But what was weird was he still had a patellar reflex. And so if you're thinking that it's something in the lower motor neuron, right, like you should not have reflexes if you're flaccid paralysis in both of your lower extremities. And he had a relatively normal patellar reflex, which was weird, like borderline hyperreflexic. And I was like, when you see that, you need to look higher up, right? So I was like, we need to get an image of the C-spine. And he had an infection up there as well. So it was like a neurosurgical emergency.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's the thing, I think, especially that's important, like with neurology, even when you're asking for a consult. Like, I always ask people, you know, like what they did on their exam, like what do the reflexes look like? Because those are important things. I mean, I'm going to recheck them and maybe not believe everything everyone says at face value, but it's just like little things like that can just guide where you're gonna, you know, take your next investigation, like whether or not you need to image higher up or do whatever. And so I feel like the nervous system is kind of predictable in that regard. It's not always predictable, but like things that we've also seen have been, you know, we've seen some CJD out here, some autoimmune encephalitis, stuff like that.
Just a quick question for the non-medical listener. What's CJD?
Oh, yes. Oh, CJD is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So it's a prion disease, kind of in the same family of mad cow. Actually, crazy story about this too. Kind of in the same family of like mad cow disease, where you have an abnormal folding of proteins in your body that causes destruction to certain structures. And one of those structures can be your brain. It can cause you to have personality changes, and like some abnormal findings on EEG, which is brainwave testing. And it has a pretty bad prognosis because usually people don't really live past like 6-ish months usually. And sometimes it's not always caught, early. It's usually something that's caught relatively late. And crazy story, I actually have a family member that, had some, you know, their own health issues, and it seemed like maybe it was a psychiatric issue. And like at one point, my one cousin, this was my third or fourth year of medical school, texted me and she's like, "What's CJD?" I was like, "What do you mean? Like, in what context?" Yeah. Saying that, like, that my other cousin was like diagnosed with it. I was like, "That makes no sense." And I was living with two other medical students at the time, and I was like, "So between all three of us, we make a doctor and a half, and all three of us disagree." And so, because that's a pretty bad diagnosis to have. I mean, my cousin is still alive. Like, there's no way that that's what she had. But it's like, people don't really, you know, those like zebras or whatever that you see, they don't always work them up appropriately or just throw that diagnosis out there without actually properly investigating it. And it's a scary diagnosis to have.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, missing that is kind of like saying someone's not pregnant who is.
Right. And it's just sad because, like, you can't do anything about it.
So. Yeah, my understanding, obviously limited, is there's not much treatment options for that disease.
Mm-mm. No, and it's weird. Like, the way people present, it often starts with, like, some personality changes, dementia, like, forgetfulness. And, yeah, it's weird. And it's usually sporadic. So it's not... there are genetic variations of it, but more often than not, it's a sporadic disease. So it just can happen to anyone, I guess.
Yeah. And so, like you said, that's kind of a zebra. What are some more of the horses that you see? Well, I guess you already answered that, but...
Well, other things are like neuropathy. And I'm sure you have seen a lot of that, right? So like... people say that they're numb in their feet when in reality they're not always numb. They just tingle sometimes, which is not the same as numbness. Yeah, I've learned I've learned the biggest thing, especially when it comes to just diagnosing like neurological disease and disorders, is the way you ask questions and the way you describe things. Dizziness is a huge one. And in reality, when you ask people about dizziness, it's like, oh, like, do you feel dizzy, like you're spinning, or are you like lightheaded, like you just kind of stood up too fast? And more often than not, people will say that it's, you know, they feel like they're just kind of woozy, lightheaded, not necessarily dizzy. Seizures is another one, and that usually is almost with anybody who's found down and like, or like moves abnormally. So like old people sometimes can have like a a convulsive syncope, and people assume that anytime someone pees themselves, it must be a seizure. But I mean, if you were on your way to the bathroom to pee yourself and you just passed out, I feel like you pee on yourself no matter what age you are.
That's a good point. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, because I mean, it's one of those things, like, you know, old people tend to not all of a sudden develop epilepsy or a seizure, right? It tends to be something a little more maybe cardiac or like metabolically related. But we get consulted on that for anyone who essentially passes out. And history is huge for that. Like, especially if anyone was like seeing that person pass out, like, how are they moving? History is just big. Like, the way that you obtain a patient's history on whatever symptom that you're seeing them for is so important, because you have mm-hmm. to ask very specific questions, and you just learn how to do that properly as you continue on. But yeah. Let's see what else. Headache, migraines is another big one. Pain and like weakness. Did I say that? Weakness.
I don't think so. So yeah. It sounds like you've, you know, with this time in, you've definitely gained a lot of experience. How do you feel you've grown from first year doing internal med versus your first full year of neurology? How do you feel like you've grown and changed?
Well, I think that second year of neurology almost feels like another intern year, but it's just, you're just doing neurology, right? So don't get me wrong, I was very happy to become a physician, and I was happy with that part of intern year, but I really don't enjoy internal medicine. I just don't, for some reason.
No, I don't either.
which is why I'm thankful that there are specialties that you can go into, that, you know, you're not just forced to do something you don't like. And I'm thankful for all my internal medicine colleagues and co-residents, you know, because they are very important and know so much about like all the systems, which I find that hard. Like sometimes for me, like it's too much. I'm like, I just can't focus on that much. I need one thing. And so it's made me thankful, I think, for my specialty. And as far as growing, I still feel like I know nothing. Like more often than not, I just feel like I don't know a whole lot. And I'm like, did I even go to medical school? What was I doing this whole time? I don't know if you can relate to that feeling.
Oh, for sure.
But I learn better when I do stuff. You know, I am very ADHD, and when I'm actually exposed to things and doing them daily, I learn better. I feel like there's just still so much that I don't fully understand sometimes and don't always comprehend. And what's also funny, it's like all the things that I never thought I was going to have to like look at or read about or know about in medical school, like metabolic pathways or, you know, the ophthalmoscope and looking in the back of the eye, which I do often. It makes me upset.
You're like, why didn't I focus on this when I had the chance to just be a student?
I didn't know. But it's like, I didn't know.
Of course.
But yeah, I think, I don't know, I love my patients too. I like being able to describe things. I think that's the biggest thing is that I pride myself in, is I think I'm really good at describing things in ways that patients from all walks of life, levels of education and whatever can understand, because the nervous system, yes, it's complicated, but it doesn't have to be that complicated for someone to actually grasp what's going on with them and their body.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that. Yeah. You know, one of the things I saw from your profile is you were an IMG, like an international medical student. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. Why is there such a stigma with that?
So I don't know why there's such a stigma. I think that, and it's not even just, you know, people who go to the school in the Caribbean, because you have people who practice medicine all over the world, right? But usually people, I went to medical school in the Caribbean, and yes, the reason why is because I didn't get into any schools here in the United States. But, I mean, they afford you the opportunity to pursue your dream, essentially. With IMGs, I don't know why there's a stigma, because I really don't think there should be, because in reality, most people who train in other countries are way more hardcore than what we do here in the United States, because also think about resources that they have available to them aren't always the same. And I just, you know, I don't really know why there even is some type of stigma. I think that it's getting better, to be honest, because I find that IMGs work their butts off. Not to say that, you know, U.S. medical graduates, both MD and DO, don't, but I think because we are told that it's going to be harder for us, then we just, we work our butts off to get clinicals, electives, all that stuff. And then you're coming in with class sizes that are huge. So it's kind of like every man for themselves. Mm-hmm. Don't always get the best guidance or advice throughout the process, which is kind of frustrating. And I think that, you know, when it comes to being, I'm a U.S. IMG as well, so that means I have U.S. citizenship, so I didn't have to worry about getting a visa, which is a whole other barrier for some people who are often more than qualified to have whatever position, like the residency position, the physician is a doctor, whatever. But the whole process of getting a visa to work in the United States is a nightmare. Which sucks because we could be definitely missing out on people who have so much to offer the medical field here in the US. And I think like it's just an unnecessary superiority complex sometimes with the United States medical system, because it's not like the most well-oiled machine.
Right, I agree.
It's like, you know, my politically correct way of saying it.
Yeah, but very much so. It's a weird stigma. It's the kind of, I'm a DO, it's the kind of same thing. We get the weird stigma, and it's kind of like you said, an unnecessary kind of just mental block that people have, especially mm-hmm. like certain fields just get really, really kind of, I don't know, condescending towards IMGs, DOs, whatever. I don't get it, because there's a lot of MDs who are idiots, for lack of a better word, and there's a lot of DOs, IMGs who are smart. There's a lot of everyone in all groups that are the spectrum of, you know, how did you get into med school versus like you're a genius, you know, all three of those categories, MD, DO, IMG, all have that, and I just don't know where that stigma comes from.
Yeah, and I mean, I have never been a straight A student. Like, statistically speaking, I should not have made it this far. Like, in reality, like, I really shouldn't have, and all of my advisors would have probably told you the exact same thing. But, I mean, I'm passionate about medicine. I'm not the type of person that's like, oh, I want to help people. Like, I love science. I love medicine. I love learning. And, like, being able to meet people and be a part of somebody's life when things are more often than not going pretty, excuse my language, shitty, is an honor, and it's a privilege, to be honest. And I think, like, yes, there are cultural differences, but the United States is not made of one type of person. And we shouldn't right. have physicians that are one type of person to treat, you know, the patient population that requires medical care.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that for sure. That's interesting. I don't know where that came from, but I'm glad you got in. I'm glad you did your thing, and you're back stateside now, and your partner's with you. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he keeps me relatively sane.
There you go. So, your future practice, you know, you're 10 years down the road. What does the ideal day in the life look like for you?
Well, I want to go into sports neurology. And I feel like I have an idea of what that entails, but I don't fully understand it just yet. I kind of know, you know, it deals with TBI and concussion and athletes, and not even just athletes, but people, you know, who've maybe had traumatic brain injury from car accidents, what have you. I'm actually going to be doing a sports neurology elective in June in Connecticut, which I'm super excited for, because then I think I'll have a better sense of like what that actually entails. Because when I was in Florida, I didn't even know this was an area of neurology until I did my elective in Miami, because the physician that I worked with used to actually run a concussion clinic at University of Miami, which was dope. It was so cool.
What was the doc's name?
Dr. Ned. Dr. Kester Ned.
Okay. He must not have been at the Miami project.
Yeah. I mean, I think he like stepped away from it. He runs the practice in Doral, but he still sees like, you know, athletes and people from all walks of life who have endured concussions and whatever. And I mean, I've realized that post-concussive syndromes and symptoms, you know, are across a broad spectrum of symptoms and presentations. You know, you deal with headache, you deal with sleep issues, you deal with psych issues. And so it's kind of a nice little mesh of things. I know that for this rotation in June, I'm pretty amped because it's with my mentor, who is also a sports neurologist, and I will get to be ringside at a MMA fight. So that'll be dope.
Nice. There's going to be a lot of good head trauma there for you.
Yeah, man. I'm super excited. Not for the people who get the head trauma, but to actually like experience like what it's like to be a ringside physician. I think that'd be pretty cool. In a perfect world, I would love to be like a team physician for like a rugby team in Australia or New Zealand. That would be like my ideal situation.
Okay.
But if I feel like it's a mix of probably outpatient and maybe like, I don't know, sideline stuff working with actual like athletic teams. But I also really like research. I like clinical research. Just haven't found something that I'm really like a good project since being in residency that I'm like passionate about. So 10 years, yeah, I'd be that, doing some clinical research as well as having like an outpatient, go into like games and living my best life.
Man, we have kind of a similar path because I'm the same way. I want to do like 30-50% of my practice be research in like sports performance, rehab, recovery, and then, you know, sideline athletic performance, sports med. That's the other half.
And where are you located now?
So I was in Asheville, North Carolina, and now I'm in Roanoke, mm-hmm. Virginia.
Okay. And do you want to stay there?
I don't really care. I have to go to fellowship, so I'll go wherever. I mean, I've been moving every year for the last 100 years, so one more year won't make a difference.
I know. I want to be on a coast. Like, that would be ideal. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you want to start a practice together, just let me know.
That might work. I mean, that would be pretty cool. We'll have to talk after this because that might be something that could actually work out. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense, especially if you're going to do, like, rehab stuff. Like, that would be, yeah, that'd be cool. Get a PM&R person up in there.
Oh, man.
Be great.
Talking my language. I did, you're doing the MMA fight soon. I wanted to tell you, so I did mixed martial arts for about 7 years. I was on a competitive team and everything, and I probably got a concussion from getting knocked out one time, but I'm not sure. But I got knocked out a lot, which is also ironic that I made it this far, because like I got knocked out a lot. You would think, oh, it's still, you're so tough. It just means my defense is terrible. It's not a good thing. But
you said you were on a competitive like team, and they still let you stay on it even though you kept getting knocked out.
I know, right? We had like 3 state champions, but still. Okay. I was not one of them. But I got knocked one time. This guy was prepping for his fight, and I was probably only a year into training, so I was like really mm-hmm. bright-eyed and super excited, and I caught this head kick, and I like went down, and I hit the ground so hard that's what woke me back up. As soon as I hit the ground, I like jumped back up and I like wobbled, but I don't remember that obviously because I was probably still unconscious, just on my feet. And the coach like stopped me and he's like, whoa, whoa, okay, you're done. You're done. I'm like, what are you talking about? I got hit. I didn't even budge. He's like, no, you got knocked out. Go sit down.
You took a nap. Just took a nap.
You took an air nap. Like I was asleep in the air, hit the ground, woke up and was like, no, I'm good. And he was like, no, go lay down. So he was a good coach.
That's so funny.
So maybe you'll get that experience and that'll be like right up your alley.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm like 90% positive you probably got concussions.
Yeah, concussions, they come and go, but glory lasts forever.
Sure. Until you can't remember the glory because, you know, you have like some type of dementia later on.
That's true, but that's what memories and Google Photos is for, you know?
Oh my God.
I'm obviously joking. Anyone listening, don't think I'm promoting getting yourself a concussion.
Yeah, please don't.
So tell me about rugby. That sounds like a pretty important aspect of your life too.
Yeah, so it wasn't a big part of it until later. And even then, I mean, my sister was at the same college that I was for undergrad, and I did a victory lap. So it took me a little later, like a little longer to graduate. College, it took me like 4.5 years. So I was working out a bunch with her at that time, and we saw that there was a women's rugby team at the college that I went to. It was Calvin College at the time, now Calvin University. It's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And so they had a men's rugby team, and they were really good, actually. It was a club sport, so it wasn't technically like a part of the school or whatever. And so they had a female rugby team, and they were recruiting players, and my sister was like, we should try it. I was like, okay, that's fine. So we did. And it was a blast. It was so much fun. And so I played for like the last little bit of college. But I mean, once you play it, in all honesty, rugby is like a cult. It's a cult sport. It's so fun. And it's not that common, I guess, especially for females, like in the US. It's more common now. Like it's gotten more attention, I think, in the last probably 10 years or so. And so it was just a really cool experience to learn this sport. I mean, it was very badass. Like, we were a very small team stature-wise and in numbers. Like, we were very tiny compared to these other women's rugby teams that we had, that we played against. Like, very tiny, but we were, like, relatively fast. I don't think we won a single game the first time I played, like, the first season I played. But, you know, it was, I eventually scored my first try the second semester I came back to play, which was was awesome, which is what they call, I don't know how familiar you are with rugby or like the terms.
I know try.
Yeah. So that's when you are able to like take the ball to the area that you can score at. Like, I don't want to call it an end zone cause that's not what it is, but, that's how you get points, is you run it down and you place it on the ground at the end of the field. And then you kick it through the uprights. So it looks similar to American football, but it is not. But yeah, I mean, you literally wear, you know, cleats, a mouth guard, and like there's special like rugby shorts that feel like denim, because like at least I wasn't in the scrum. My sister was the forward player. I was a back player. So you have like your forward players, which tend to be your bigger people, and then your back players are your faster people that run the ball forward. And so I was a fly half, which is like the person who gets the ball thrown to like for the scrum half and kind of like throws it like down the line to get it to the wing person who can run up and hopefully score. But yeah, I don't know. It was so much fun. Plus like to tell people that I played rugby, and then I always got these looks like, oh, you don't look like the type that. And I'm like, yeah, well, I've been told that my whole life about everything. I don't look like the type that would going. Do X. Yeah. I think I have Napoleon complex. I think I'm much bigger and like stronger than I actually am, but yeah, that was such a blast. And like I said, it's pretty much like a cult. Like once you've played it, if you meet anyone that plays rugby, and I used to play like pickup games in Grenada with a bunch of guys down there in my last term, which was so fun.
I bet that was sweet.
Oh yeah. I mean, it wasn't like tackle, it was just touch, but it was a blast. I felt it was a very good stress reliever to just go like tackle people at the end of a long day.
Oh yeah, the aggressive, I'll say aggressive, not violent, but aggressive sports. Mm-hmm. Like fighting, rugby, lacrosse, I mean, there's no better stress relief. Like I played soccer, yeah, basketball, lacrosse in high school, and lacrosse was definitely the least stressful. Like, well, I felt the best because I had the most stress relief.
Yeah, yeah. And like, I mean, rugby, like I bruise very badly. Like I used to look like, and I would wear my bruises like so proud of them, you know. I would wear shorts if I had them really bad or like whatever, because I love to show them off. And like I got cleated one time like down my thigh, and it looked like I got scratched by like a bear. And like over like the next couple of days, it bruised out so bad. Like it looked so bad. And it really, like, the injury, the way I got it, wasn't that bad. But it looked like I may or may not have been thrown down the stairs. Like,
oh, my God. That's funny.
Not good.
So the other question I had for you was, procrastinate much, given your name?
Yes. It's a problem. It is a problem. Like, even, like, with stuff like posting it onto my Instagram, I'm like, I'm going to do it this week. And I never do. It's bad. I feel like that a lot of that obviously has to do with my ADHD. I try and be good about, you know, having a planner and all this stuff, but I am very ADHD, so I get distracted very easily, and then I'll forget what I'm doing, and then I'll be like, oh, I can't do that right now, and I have to do something else. So yes, it is me. Like, I am a very big procrastinator, but I need to get better about it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I feel you. You know, procrastination can bite you in the butt sometimes. And then other times it can really be a blessing. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. My dog at one of my apartments, she locked herself in the bathroom and tried to dig her way out. So she basically dug the, well, no, excuse me. She locked, I, anyway, whatever. She was locked out of some room. She tried to dig her way out and she dug the carpet, like the under carpet, all the way down to the concrete.
Oh my and God.
They were like, oh, it's going to be $700 to repair it. And so I just lived with it for like 8 more months. Mm-hmm. And when I moved out, they were like, oh, we're actually going to replace the carpet in your place anyway, so we won't charge you for it.
Nice.
So the procrastination Very nice. Saved me like $800.
That is nice. I mean, I think like, honestly, like with procrastinating, sometimes I feel like the reason why I might procrastinate on some things is because, I don't know if you, I'm sure you probably have just because of being in medicine, having imposter syndrome, right? And just like thinking like, oh, like I shouldn't be here or whatever. And so sometimes I think that that procrastination with certain things comes from like a fear of failure, which I feel like a lot of people who are in very demanding jobs and like academically, like if you're in medical school and whatever, sometimes like that is a big reason why a lot of people procrastinate. But again, it's just one of those things that I need to continue to work on, but we'll probably never, I will never conquer it. And that's okay.
That is okay. That's a good theory. So we're pretty much done. There's like 2 more questions I wanted to ask you. You know, 2 years into residency, has medicine been what you expected?
That's a great question. I don't really know how to answer that, but I mean, yes and no. I think yes, in that there's always like things that are changing, new evidence and data for certain treatments or protocols for specific diseases and disease courses and stuff like that. You know, that aspect I think is what I anticipated it to be. But I think the whole process of practicing medicine is much harder just because of either where you're at for the hospital, the patient population you treat. You know, and like I said earlier, it's not exactly like the medical healthcare system is a well-oiled machine, but sometimes it is just really hard to treat your patients in the most efficient and best way possible just because of limitations with the medical industry, be it insurance, you know, be it psychosocial factors for the patient, you know, even just thinking about it personally, like with like I have health insurance, right? But going to the doctors is expensive. Like it can be very expensive. And I think that's the part that I really wasn't prepared for. And I think that is, in all honesty, sometimes the most frustrating part of practicing medicine, particularly in the US. You know, I don't really have a comparison for other countries because I've not practiced in other countries, but as far as what I've learned in the last 2 years here, it's just sometimes hard, yeah, to provide your patients with the best care possible because you can't control everything.
Yeah, you say, hey, come back in 2 weeks, but them getting off work to come see you that right. one time was a huge hassle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's a lot of nuance to it. Yeah, like patients missing an appointment or being late to an appointment because the bus was running late, like that's tough.
Right. I mean, and then you have your patients who, like, you know, will be like, oh, I had court the same morning. It's like, you knew that, though, like weeks ago. Like, you knew that.
That's also true. I forgot about those. Like, yeah, I usually give them the benefit of the doubt, but, you know,
yeah, that is frustrating. It's like, you have both ends of the spectrum. And so sometimes it's just, you just got to pick your battles. Like, you just, you know. Whatever. Sometimes you just gotta show up when they show up, and you know, I do have a very low threshold for people being late, though.
What is your clinic's policy?
So we have a 20-minute window.
Frustrating.
Yeah, but I mean, and the front office staff knows with me, like I will not squeeze people in just because it's like I can't. Like, if you want to sit around and wait, and if someone doesn't show up for their appointment, that's fine. But, you know, if you showed up 20 minutes late to a flight, you know, it'd be gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I don't know why. And again, it's like, yes, I'm here and my time is just as valuable as yours. But it's like, to me, like, if people, even just if someone were to call and say, hey, I'm running late, like, I'm more apt to like see that person than like the person who just doesn't call. And I know it's easier said than done sometimes, but like, I don't know. To me, being on time is important, because it's just respectful of the person's time, not just mine, but theirs as well.
Yeah. And I think you and I are probably similar in that sense. It's, we're not trying to put anyone down. There's millions of reasons why people are late, but you know, it's like you said, the flight is a good example. You know, our time, patient time, we have our own lives. We have stuff we have to do. So we're both human. So yeah, yeah. I totally agree. The other question is, now that you're larger in charge, halfway done with residency.
You get me choking over here.
You know, halfway done with residency, what is your advice to people coming up? So med students, pre-meds, anyone on their way up looking at you as the person that is their end goal?
That's a great question. I think the biggest thing is, you know, if someone tells you maybe this isn't the path for you purely based on your GPA or your MCAT score or whatever, that take whatever they say with a grain of salt, especially if it's someone who's coming from a place that hasn't been through the whole process. And I think asking for help is super important along the process. Also, knowing when you should ask for help is important. I didn't learn those lessons until much later in my 20s, which I wish I would have known sooner, only because I was very stubborn. But it's not easy. It's not meant to be easy. And, you know, if this is something that you're passionate about and something that you really want to go into, then go for it. Understand, obviously, that it comes with a lot of sacrifice. It comes with a lot of tears. A lot of, you know, new relationships with people, friends, what have you, ending relationships with people and friends throughout that process. It's not easy, but at the end of the day, I think it's worth it. And, you know, again, when it comes to, I think advice is the biggest thing. Not all advice is good advice, and you're not always going to know the difference, especially early on. But usually it's the people who, even if they don't know the answer to your questions, point you in the direction of someone who can help you, are very important people in your lives, and you should keep them around if you can. You know, don't get discouraged along the way. We've all been in that position before, thinking like, oh my gosh, can I even do this? And more often than not, you feel like you can't, but you will be surprised with what you can actually endure and achieve along the way. But don't neglect yourself. Don't neglect yourself. And also take care of your skin. Like, start a good skin regimen early, early.
I definitely agree with all that. The skin regimen threw me for a loop. That's funny.
Like, no, I mean it though. Like, I 100% mean it, because you will not be a well hydrated, well nourished, always on top of everything individual, but you can wash your face every day.
That's very true. You know, I was on my dermatology rotation a couple of weeks ago, and it was amazing because they had this just stock room of samples, and they were like, oh, here's like 5 grocery bags, fill it up. And I did. And I loved it.
Yeah, I would 100% do that.
It's like, you know, those things are $40 each, and they have these like pretty solid sample size. So I grabbed like 4 samples of each thing, and I've been going crazy. My skin feels amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth it. Hey, I started using anti-wrinkle cream when I was like 25. I don't know if it's helping, but it makes me feel good about myself, I guess.
Yeah. There's something about that regimen that's helpful. I usually just use like Noxzema, and like some, if I'm feeling real special, I'll buy like face moisturizer. Otherwise, I just have lotion that's for arms, legs, and face.
Yeah, you have like the boy skin regimen. Like you just one thing, like one shit, like the shampoo, conditioner, body wash in one. Like,
see, I'm not there in the shower. I'm very particular. I have like my conditioner. I have my shampoo. I have like two different face washes. I have like my bike backwash, you know, for like the acne backwash with like the scrubber. Yeah. Then I have like my body wash and like my soap. Like the showers, that's specific. But once I get out, it's, you know, one size fits all.
Yeah. Well, it shouldn't be. you should get on a skin regimen. You need good face wash, you know, good moisturizer. I'm really bad about sunscreen, but, you know, you might like work a 24-hour shift, but at least your skin can feel much better than what you feel internally.
Yeah. That'll help you from not looking like you just worked 24 hours.
Exactly.
Sweet. Well, Jess, thank you so much for your time. It was awesome catching up with you on the phone before this. It was awesome recording this. I'm super happy you have your partner with you. Super happy you're knocking on 30 years door and just keep kicking butt. It sounds like you're doing great.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I really appreciate you having me on your podcast as well and getting to know you a little bit in the process. And I am like pretty serious about maybe opening a practice at some point.
Yeah, I am serious as well. That sounds pretty awesome. So any parting words, any shout outs you need to give?
No, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, you know, just like I said, get you a skincare regimen.
I think that's next on my list to do. I'll go through all those different samples and I'll pick something out.
I guess that, and be true to yourself in the process. You know, if, like being a doctor and whatever you want to do, whatever, like it doesn't need to fit into like a certain type of whatever, like that this is what a doctor looks like. A doctor or like a lawyer or whatever looks like you just in that role.
Love that. So that sounds good. You know, I'll make sure I tag you in the post and get your social media and everything out there so if people can reach out to you. But I'm sure if anyone needs anything along the way, you're more than happy to be a resource for them.
Yeah, for sure. ProcrastinationMD on Instagram. I answer all my messages.
Right on. Well, thanks again.
Thank you. Have a good night.
All right. That was the ProcrastinationMD. Hope you all enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in as always. Please follow us on Instagram at Our Lives in Medicine. Check out all the links in the bio. And also share the episode with anyone if you think they'll enjoy it. And as always, to those in the game and those on their way up, keep grinding and don't let anyone take your dream away from you. You're supposed to kiss.